kindness is near and dear to Unitarian Universalists. We don't have a lot of interest in other worlds, in theological pronouncements. Do I need to just use this one? Okay. Rather than other worlds and concepts and stuff, we're really much more drawn, when it comes down to it, to this world and how we treat one another with fairness, with equity, with worth and dignity. We value kindness. I lost my notes. Metta is a Buddhist word for kindness. Actually, in Pali, in the original text, the root of metta is mitri, which means friend. So metta is a friendliness towards all. True kindness is not highfalutin. It's really simple, ordinary, unpresumptuous friendliness. Like the way Naomi Shihab Nye cared for the Palestinian woman, the way the woman shared her mamul. Are you getting the hum? Okay. So I'm gonna switch this. Better. Is that one working? I'm sorry, we'll just have to do without the locus. So as I was saying, real kindness is not puffed up. It's not actually a big deal. It's very simple, like the way Naomi Shihab Nye cared for the older Palestinian woman, the way the woman shared the mamul, the way everyone at Gate 4A began to smile to each other. I've practiced Buddhist meditation for over 40 years anyway. It's taught me a lot about kindness and friendliness. Buddhism is probably better known for mindfulness, for kindness, for insight and wisdom rather than kindness. But wisdom without kindness just is not very wise, right? And kindness without wisdom is not very kind. So kindness, wisdom, peace are all deeply intertwined. They're just different ways of looking at the same wholesome quality. So this morning I'd like to share with you a little of what I have learned from Buddhist practice about ways of cultivating kindness. The model, the overall model, looks something like this. We all suffer. Pain, hurt, discouragement, depression, bummers. Anyone here never suffered? Okay. The Buddha never said life is suffering. That's a misquote. What he said was life has suffering, along with love and contentment and generosity and lots of other qualities. They're all kind of mixed in together in this world. So when we look openly and gently beneath our suffering, we look inside beneath those, we start to notice a tenderness. Without tenderness, we wouldn't hurt. And if we look openly and gently beneath our tenderness, we notice a kind of spaciousness. Without openness, you know, there'd be no tenderness. On the spiritual path, many people look for spaciousness and the wisdom and clarity that come with that. And as a way of getting there, they want to push aside the pain, get away from the discomfort, the hurt, the upset, try to do an end run around all those things. It doesn't work. You can do it for a while, but in the long run, it just doesn't work. Because if we turn away from our discomfort, we are also turning away from the natural tenderness within us and the kindness beneath it. So it's much more effective to just turn towards the discomfort and relax. We can ignore the stories, the justifications, the concepts, all that stuff generated by our minds, and instead just soften into the feel of that tenderness. And we can continue to relax from that through the tenderness until we begin to notice it's really a simple kind of quiet well-being that's just waiting to be noticed. And then we can savor that well-being and just let it soak into our bones. So this is the path to kindness that I've learned from Buddhism, and I think resonates so deeply with Unitarian Universalism. Turning towards, relaxing into, and savoring. And if you think that sounds naive, I don't blame you. You know, we live in polarized times. Ill will flows from some of the most powerful people in the world. Mean-spiritedness can drown out friendliness, worry and hurry, fear and stress, greed and meism. Just take our kinder inclinations and shove them under a rock. Turning towards, relaxing into, and savoring are very simple, but they're not always easy. So this morning, I want to just spend a little time with each of those three practices. For those of you who are familiar with Buddhism, these three practices have been passed down to us under the title Four Noble Truths. But if you look at what the Buddha actually said about the four truths, you'll see that they are not capital T truths. They're not metaphysical declarations. They're just really simple observations. And there's a practice that's associated with each of those. There's an article on my website, dougcraft.com, if you're curious about this. It's called Turning Towards, in which I go through some of the text line by line and show how the Four Noble Truths are really just these three practices. But for this morning, I thought it'd be a lot kinder to spare you from all that geekiness and just describe the practices themselves and how they can help surface kindness in our everyday life. So I'll go through each practice. In the text, the first practice is called fully understanding suffering. Fully understanding. It's a tricky word. To fully understand someone, you have to have more than a clinical diagnosis, right? You have to know them empathetically. You have to have a feel for them underneath. You know, how they tick, what inspires them, what frightens them. What do they yearn for? What do they struggle with? To fully understand ourselves, we have to have that same kind of empathy towards ourselves. So to fully understand suffering, we must fully understand the nature of suffering, how it arises, how it hangs around for a while, how it eventually fades. We have to know how bummers feel, not just an intellectual concept about them. And again, it helps not to get wrapped up in the storylines about them, but just to see the process itself. We're never going to get that kind of deep understanding if we're busy turning away, if we're running away from the hurt, if we're trying to rise above it or push it away. We must experience it intimately without resistance. Intimately without resistance. Here's a way you can think about it. I grew up in Houston, Texas, and on hot summer afternoons, hot summer days, I, along with my four brothers and one sister, would tumble into our blue and white Chevrolet station wagon, and my mother would drive us down to the Gulf of Mexico, down to Galveston, so we could go out and swim in the Gulf. Houston is 60 miles from Galveston, and Houston is 60 feet above sea level. So that gives you some idea of what the terrain is like. It slopes down at a rate of 1 foot per mile. It's about as flat as you can imagine. And when the land hits the Gulf, it doesn't get much steeper. So as kids, we could walk 100, 200 feet out into the Gulf and still only be up to our waist in the water. So if a wave came along and we tried to run from it, it was futile, right? Running through water is very, very difficult, and the shore was so far away. If we tried to get away from it, it would just catch up with us, hit us from behind, and knock us flat. So we braced our feet, dug our toes into the sand, and braced against a wave. And that worked when the waves were small. But waves are really, the water is heavy, you know? So with the big waves, they would just wipe us out. And eventually figured out what the way you greet a big wave is to relax into it. And if it's really big, you relax and dive into it. And as frothy and scary as the waves may be as they come roaring towards us, when you just relax and dive into it, the surf passes over you, and you're left right in the essence of the wave, right? Which is seawater. Not a big deal. Not a big deal. And then our natural buoyancy would just carry us up to that little piece, that little trough of peace between the waves. If we try to run from discomfort, it's going to catch us from behind and knock us flat. If we try to push discomfort below the surface, it's sort of like trying to push a beach ball under the water. You know, you can do it, but it takes a lot of effort, and when you relax, it just pops back up in your face. The Buddha said, face discomfort openly. Until you know how it works, you must truly understand. Our lives get washed by all kinds of waves. Loving our kids, worrying about our kids, falling in love, relationship kerfuffles, financial strain, good fortune, health, illness, embarrassment, satisfaction, on and on and on, wave after wave. When we engage life's difficulties openly, we see how these waves arise, come along, and pass. And I'm not saying we have to be passive. Sometimes there are things that we need to do. There's things we need, ways we're committed to living in this world, and sometimes we need to engage it. But if we cultivate a little bit of peace and kindness before we act, our actions are more likely to be born of wisdom. When we turn towards and open up to life's difficulties, open up to those waves, we begin to see that our actual experience, our inner experience of difficulty, arises out of tension. This brings us to the second of these practices, relaxing into. The Buddha said that suffering arises out of a specific kind of tension, and that the tension must be, it's a very dramatic word, the tension must be abandoned. How do you abandon tension? Relax. Relax. It's really that simple. Relax the body, relax the mind, relax the emotions. Notice that you don't abandon the suffering. You know, we don't try to walk away from it, rise above it, turn lemons into lemonade, grin and bear it. Since we're not trying to get away from it, when you relax, it feels like you're relaxing into it. You relax into your anger. What a concept. Relax into fear. Soften into loneliness. Let down into grief. Whatever comes along, turn towards it and soften into it. It may not bring immediate relief, but as you release the tension, when there's no more tension, there's nothing left to fuel the suffering, and it will subside. When we relax that way, we may begin to experience something very simple, but it's a little extraordinary. We may experience these simple moments of what I would call pure awareness. And all I mean by pure awareness is awareness that doesn't have an agenda. You know, it's just open up and looking, seeing what's there, rather than looking for something specific. And the more we do that, we begin to suspect that the little bit of quiet may have been there all along. It's as if we're in this classroom, we're a teacher in a classroom, and there are all these kids, and they're banging chairs and throwing erasers and whole hubbub. And meanwhile, over there in the corner next to the window, there's a student writing poetry. And we wouldn't know it because of all the hubbub. And one morning we come into class early, and the classroom is empty, except the young poet is over there. And so we go and we sit down next to her, maybe talk a little bit, or maybe just sit quietly as she composes. And gradually, the students come in with their boom boxes and punching each other in the arm, and all the, pretty soon the cacophony is back. And then, even amidst the cacophony, you can still sense the poet over there, because you know what she feels like. Like the poet in the classroom, pure awareness is with us all the time. Without pure awareness, we wouldn't have any awareness at all. Ordinary awareness is just pure awareness with a lot of junk on top of it. So what's pure awareness like? You want to experiment a little bit and see if we can just see it directly? Okay, try this. Stop thinking. So what happens? You know, maybe a little startle, maybe a little bit of amusement. Was there a split second there? There was nothing? Maybe it went by too quickly. So let's try it again. We'll go at it a little more gently. So I'm going to raise my arm. I'm going to let it drop. Okay. And when I let my arm drop, just let go of all your thoughts. Don't manage them. Don't try to put them away. Just drop them. Okay, shall we try this? Let's do it again. You don't have to raise your arm. You can if you want. But. And just let your thoughts drop. Notice a moment there, a split second, maybe a third of a breath, and then the thoughts start back up again. You don't actually do it. The thoughts just start themselves. Let's try it one more time. Just see what happens. Just let your thoughts drop. It's very, very difficult to maintain that quiet for a length of time. It's actually not that hard, though, to just drop your thoughts, even if it's for a split second, and to just notice it. One other little experiment here. What I invite you to do is to relax. I'm glad too many people didn't shift. It's nice to know some people. Okay. Just relax and just gaze around the room for a little bit and just notice what you notice. Don't go look for anything, just a receptive kind of awareness. The things up here on the stage, the people around you, just gaze around gently. And as you do that, thoughts may come up. Oh, there's a flag. What's he talking about? Hope they have chocolate cake. Little thoughts will come up. Don't fight with them. Just let them sort of drift out the door. And see if you notice a quiet underneath the looking and the gazing. Sort of like shifting your attention from the clouds to the sky itself. Notice the awareness within which the thoughts and perceptions arise. As in some traditions in the Tibetan Mahamudra tradition, some of the instructions are just to do that 250 times a day, even if it's just for a half a breath, just a break, and just notice that little pause there. Pure awareness is not just an absence, right? It has a feel, it has a texture. Very quiet, but it does feel kind, it does feel peaceful, wise, a little impersonal, patient. It has all the qualities that are often attributed to a benevolent deity. All right there. You don't have to believe in God to feel that. You can call it God. You can call it human essence. You can call it Buddha nature. You can call it the force. You can call it pixie dust. Call it spadoodle. It doesn't make any difference what we call it. They're just labels and concepts. The important thing is just to feel that and notice it on its own terms, even if it's fleeting. This brings us to the third practice, savoring peace, well-being, other wholesome qualities. In the text, the word is realize, as in make real. So how do you make an experience real? You let it soak in. When we abandon tension, it subsides, and the remaining peacefulness may be so quiet that we don't notice it. Our attention is drawn to tension, so it just skips over it. I find so often sitting in meditation or walking through the woods along the river, my mind becomes sort of softly luminous and glowing, and I don't even know it. You know, I'm much more familiar with striving, with figuring things out and working, stuff like that. So the peacefulness back in there, it doesn't jump up and down and wave its hands and say, here I am, here I am, here I am. It doesn't do anything to draw our attention to it. But as we notice it, even for a few moments, we can allow it to stretch out. It doesn't help to try to grab hold of it, but just notice it. When our boys were young, we tried to keep them away from sugar as much as we could. We were totally outgunned. We tried, but we didn't want them to develop a big complex about this. So once a week, they could have a little glass of soda. And it was usually on a Saturday morning. And my son Damon would take his little glass and put it on the kitchen table, and he would look at it, and he would bring his cheek down to it and feel the little sparkly bubbles, and he would smell it, and then he would take a little sip. I have no idea where he learned that. It wasn't from me. Savoring just means absorbing the loveliness. Really simple. And as we savor the peace, as we savor the well-being, kindness grows in it quite naturally. And we begin to see where it comes from. Okay. So, another little thought experiment. Imagine all day you've been wanting something sweet. And finally, towards the end of the day, you get, a little bite of mango or a piece of chocolate, and you take that in, and the first bite, it's just bliss until you go for the next bite. Right? You know that place? The problem we have is that we have come to believe that happiness comes from getting what we want. The advertising industry preaches this, right? Happiness comes from getting what we want, getting rid of what we don't want. But when you take that bite, if rather than pay attention to the taste of the chocolate, you just use a little bit of awareness to look at the quality of your mind, you'll notice that as you take that first bite, the desire for chocolate is gone. The hankering is gone. You don't want it anymore because now you've got it. So the mistake we make is we confuse getting what we want with not wanting. So we grab for the next thing and grab for the next, and as soon as we grab for the next, well, that's just greed, you know, and then the bliss is just wiped out. So a deeper, a little more stabler kind of happiness comes from realizing the happiness actually doesn't come from a mango tree or a cocoa bush. It actually comes from in here. When liking and disliking subside. Lao Tzu, you all know Lao Tzu. He wrote, "You're rich when you know you have enough." And we all focus on getting more rather than seeing what's enough. So as the desire fades, the contentment grows, then kindness just makes more and more sense. And sometimes that realization can come like a flash of lightning, like it hit Saul on the road to Damascus. But more often it emerges subtly in just an ordinary way. Like Naomi Shihab Nye. Just seeing an old woman crying is reminded of her grandmother. And at that point, the only thing that makes sense is just putting her arm around her and asking, "Can I help?" Ralph Waldo Emerson said, he wrote, "To know even one life has breathed easier because you have lived, this is to have succeeded." And with this, we sense that the source of peace, the source of kindness, the source of well-being has been patiently here all along, just like the poet in the classroom. Including in this moment. Can you feel it? It's okay if you don't, but just know it's there and just open and see what's there. So we'll close with a little few moments of silence. I'll offer a few words of contemplation, and then we will come out of that singing. So if you'd like to just close your eyes or let them come to rest. Think of some difficulty in your life. It can be something large or small. Maybe it pulls your spirits down a little bit. Let go of your stories and ideas about it. Let them wander off as you turn towards the feeling of that situation. What's its texture? What's it like inside? What's your mood as you look at it? You notice any tension inside? Could be in your body or your thoughts or your emotions. If you notice any tension, just invite it to soften. Don't push the situation aside. Just let any tension or any thickness in the mind or heart soften. If any relief or ease comes up, just sit quietly. Or if it just sits quietly in the background, just let it come up. Relax into it. Savor it. Smile just a little bit. See how that feels. Savor. On a whale watch, a friend of a friend noticed these three huge whales protecting seals from orca. And it was fascinating, and he got to thinking, what's the evolutionary advantage of whales protecting seals from orca? It's actually quite simple. Intelligent species grow smart because their brains continue to mature for many, many years after they're born. Bees are born as adults. They hatch and they're full adults. We humans don't reach our full potential, you know, for 10 or 20 years. We are all born helplessly dependent. So intelligent species, if they're going to survive and pass their DNA along, have to have a very strong instinct to care for the young, to care for those in need. And there's no evolutionary advantage for that to focus just on our own, so it tends to spread out. As we turn towards, relax into, and savor any peace and well-being that arise, we are not transformed into something new. We are relaxing back into what has been here all along, just waiting to be noticed. Just waiting to be noticed. Go in peace. Go in kindness. Go with patience. Namaste.